You're listening to Dwelling Place Church Podcast.
The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength in whom I trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. You know, I've used this before. I always quoted the verse, or we sang songs about it, about the horn of salvation, and I never really thought about it until a couple years ago. I sat down to kind of read a little bit more about it, and I was like, the horn of my salvation? You know, I'm thinking like a clown horn, like, rah, rah, you know. Not really, doesn't really fit the part, I don't think, in the Bible. So I started looking it up, and horn actually has two meanings. And one meaning is it comes from, you know, the source of an animal. A horn is something that signifies strength and power and dominance. It's something that overthrows something else. You know, animals use their horn to overtake something. And the other definition means a horn as in like a summit or a peak, a top of a hill. And so when you read the verse again, and it says, my shield and the horn of my salvation, you know, I really started studying it, and God was kind of like, I am the horn of your salvation. So he's two-part. He's something that is so powerful that it can overthrow things. It's something that is the emblem of who God is. But at the same point, it becomes the high point in our salvation. God wants to be the high point over all of the things that we're going through, whether they're good or they're bad. He wants to be so powerful and so prominent over anything that's going on, but he also wants to be the high point, the summit, the top of the peak, the very highest point in our lives where our salvation can come in, and everything that follows who God is, all that God is love and mercy and grace, and everything that's good is God. And so everything, since it's good that it's God, it's the high point in our life. And so it should overshadow everything that is going on. And I don't know about you, but a lot of times I tend to make my circumstances much more powerful than the God that I serve. You know, you can be going through a really, really good point in your life, and things are going good, and things are going good, and things are going really good, and one after another, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, things are so good, and then one thing happens, and it ruins it all. You ever had that? And all of a sudden, your salvation's out the window. You wonder who God really is. Am I an agnostic? Maybe he's not there. You know, whatever it is, but no longer is God the horn of your salvation. He's now just kind of the hill and the valley of wherever you're at. Maybe he's going to come through. You're not really sure what God's going to do. But when you make God the horn of your salvation, and he overshadows everything else in your life, and he becomes the high point, then it doesn't matter how low your life can feel, because you know that your salvation's up here, and your grace and your mercy that God has given to you now has become the point of your salvation, and everything is overshadowed by who God is. So I think a lot of times we go through life and we think, oh my gosh, we've got this circumstance, or I've got this coming around the corner, and things have been really good, but I know something's about to happen. I don't know what it is. And we tend to lose our hope because we lose our focus of where the summit, the peak, the horn of our salvation is. So I want to show you this quick video, and it's going to kind of sum it up, and then we'll come back. kind of cuts off there at the end. But, you know, those verses are based off of Job. And I'm going to read some verses here in Isaiah that are similar. It says this, and this is the Message version. It says, "Why would you ever complain, O Jacob, or whine, Israel, saying, 'God has lost track of me'?" You ever feel like that? "He doesn't care what happens to me. Don't you know anything? Haven't you been listening? God doesn't come and go. God lasts. He's creator of all you can see or imagine. He doesn't get tired out, doesn't pause to catch his breath, and he knows everything inside and out. He energizes those who get tired, gives fresh strength to dropouts, for even young people tire and drop out. Young folk in their prime stumble and fall. But those who wait upon God get fresh strength. They spread their wings and soar like eagles. They run and don't get tired. They walk and they don't lag behind." You know, isn't it kind of cool to think that, you know, as I was sitting and studying before tonight, I was thinking, we serve a God that when you ask him something, he doesn't have to stop and think about it. I mean, think about it. Like, you're having to think about it. God doesn't have to stop and think about anything. Like, you don't have to ask him a question and he go, "Oh, let me think." No, he never does that. He knows everything. He knows it all. There's nothing to compare him to. And that's what the Bible's saying. How can we question God's plan for us when we realize who he really is? That there is nothing comparable to who God is. You can't compare him to another man. You can't compare him to anything that was created. So that means everything that we know of us and our world and our surroundings, all of that's created. Nothing on earth can compare to who God is. And we sing about it on Sunday mornings. We talk about it on Wednesday nights. We talk about how God is incomparable. But when you sit and think about it, think about the fact that God never has to sit and think about anything. He is. He knows. He was and is. He'll be there tomorrow. He's already there tomorrow, and we're not even there yet. And we don't even live in Australia. Go figure. All right. Joshua. I love the story of Joshua. So we find ourselves in the book of Joshua, and what's happened is the Israelites have come from Egypt. They were under Moses. They wandered. You know, they were weird. They wandered. They didn't follow God's ways. They had good. They had bad. The sea parted. Manna fell. Water came out of a rock. I mean, all these crazy miracles happened. They made a golden calf, and they worshipped it, which was weird. And then they had to drink it, which is even more bizarre. The Bible's really bizarre if you start reading it. But then we find all these miracles that happens, but they doubted God. And so in the end, even though they came out of Egypt and what should have only been a short distance to their promised land, it took them 40 years, but by the time they reached it, they had rebelled so much that God told them, none of you are going to see the promised land except for a small amount, a couple people. That's it. So a brand new generation has to wait until all the old people die. How would you like to be that last guy, right? Is he dead yet? Can we go to the promised land? He's the last one remaining. Somebody knock him off. Yeah, think about it. He's the last guy in the tent of the generation. Everybody had to know who he was. There had to be a reason. His name's not in the Bible. Just saying. But either way, so we've now come to the point where Moses has died, and God has given them the authority to go into the promised land and take over possession. Take what's rightfully yours, what God has said belongs to you. And so Joshua is now in charge, and all these miracles start happening again. So the Red Sea parts again. I mean, they overcome city after city, and they have a couple failures. You know, they go into Ai, and everything's lost, and then they find out somebody rebelled and didn't do what God told them to do, and so they redo it. They eventually conquer it right, but they have miracle after miracle after miracle. So we find ourselves in chapter 11, and Rahab's been saved. I mean, all this amazing stuff. But we get here to these verses where it's one of those points where I talked about where everything's going really, really good, really, really good, really, really good, really, really good, and then something happens, and people start coming against Joshua. How could they come against Joshua? God's following Joshua. God's telling Joshua what to do. And Joshua finds himself in a situation where he feels like, you ever feel like one of those reeds that are bending? You know, a stick that you think is never going to break, but it finally does. You go just far enough. Or, you know, what they call the tipping point, which is the point where it's not over here enough and it's not over here, but if it just goes a little bit further, It's all going to be over. It's going to tip over. It's the tipping point. That one thing, that one drop that puts it over. That one piece of hay that's too heavy. That one little thing that makes it too much. So we find this in Joshua 11. It says, and it came to pass, and I'm going to get a lot of these names wrong, so good luck with that. Thank you, Mom. All right, and it came to pass, when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, that he sent to Jobab. Now, what he heard, let me stop. What he had heard is that Joshua and the Israelites and their God have been sweeping through these lands and conquering these bad kings and taking all of their stuff, and they are now wealthy. They have stuff. I mean, think about it. They came out of Egypt with stuff that they can't use in the desert. I mean, gold doesn't really do a whole lot in the desert. And so they're wandering for 40 years with just stuff that gets old and tiring and dried out, and now they're in a place where they got all this new stuff that they conquered. So word about what Joshua and his God has done has been pretty bad. So it says, let's see, and it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, to the king of blah, 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 to the other king, and to the kings who were from the north and in the mountains, and the plain of the south of somewhere. We keep going down, and then we start finding to the Canaanites in the east, and the west, and the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and all these ites, right? All right, so they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in the multitude. Now, you know it's got to be bad when the Bible says it's as many people, it's as many as the sand on the seashore in multitude, with very many horses and chariots. And when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Well, that kind of makes for a bad day, right? You've done really, really good. And then not just like one or two people come against you, like thousands and thousands and millions. A lot of people come against you. A lot of stuff. It says so many that it was like the sands on the seashore. That's got to be pretty bad. Kind of a bad day to wake up to. I don't know, wrong side of the bed. It's estimated that over 20,000 horses and chariots. Now, here's the thing. 20,000 horses and chariots. It wasn't like little ponies. It wasn't like, oh, that's a cute little horse. These were fighting horses. These were horses that were built to be strong. These were the strongest of the strongest, the best of the best. The chariots were warrior chariots. I mean, this was like top-notch stuff. All of the best of their armies was sent out against Joshua. How would you like that? But God says he's going to win, right? Yeah. So, I counted through there. You don't have to go back and count. 16 different kings and kingdoms that came against Joshua and the Israelites. How's that for like a group of bullies, right? 16 different kings. So you not only have a king, but you have all his people under him and all his army and all his friends, and then another king and all his people under him and all his army. All these people are surrounding Joshua. So it says, Joshua 11:6, but the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. Now, two things. Tomorrow? Like, that would be my question. Tomorrow? Like, they're out there right now. Do we got to wait all the way till tomorrow this time? But yet, he had to wait all the way till tomorrow. Like, if there's 20,000 horses and chariots standing before me ready to kill me, and God says, it's okay, by this time tomorrow, they'll all be dead. I'd be like, now is a good time. Now you can usher in the presence of God. No, tomorrow. But it says, he says something specific. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. Now, why would he tell them to hamstring their horses? I looked it up. It says that when a horse has their hamstring cut or torn, basically, even with surgery, a horse is useless. It's a really, really small chance that a horse would survive long enough or be good enough to be of any use once their hamstring is cut. And so what happened was God went to Joshua and said, take the thing that they consider their most powerful weapon, their horses and their chariots, and burn them and kill them. So he did. 20,000 horses and chariots are destroyed. So it means that the one thing that all of these men, all of this other army and all the other kings and kingdoms, the one stronghold that they stood on was their power and their might and how defiant they could look and how big they can look and how strong and powerful the horn, how majestic they can come against. And so God says, go in and destroy that stronghold, that thing that they consider their biggest thing against you. But at the same time, that means that he's got to go in and cut all the hamstring and burn all the chariots. Nothing like getting close to your enemies, right? So he's been out in the desert for 40 years. Now listen to this. Think about it. They go out in the desert. They don't take horses and stuff with them. There's no water there. So think about all this stuff. They get to the Red Sea where it says that God parted the Red Sea. Can you imagine standing at the shore after wandering, growing up in the desert? There's not a lot of water in the desert to swim in. Chances are pretty good. Most of them didn't swim. So God probably had to part the Red Sea, either that or teach them to swim really fast. But it seemed like every time they come up against something right at the edge, it's always like right there. Like, you ever notice God's never early? God's never like, no, let's start a little early. We're all ready. God never does that. No. He waits till like you think it's over. God, we're at the edge of the water. Oh, yeah, well, go ahead, just start walking in, and then I'll part the Red Sea. But you don't even know he's gonna part the Red Sea. You know, we have personal circumstances that we're like, okay, like, now's a good time, God. Now is a really good time. No. We sit around. But ultimately, we have to come to the conclusion that God is the horn of my salvation. Everything that I hinge my Christianity on is God. If God's taken away, I got nothing. So that means the horn of my salvation, everything that I consider the strength of my life, has to be hinged on God. And if it's hinged on God, then there's nothing comparable to it. So that means these small little details of my life that I consider really, really big and a stronghold, and oh my gosh, it may take me out. Well, it can't. Because I've got the horn of salvation who's so much higher and bigger and covers everything. And as long as I keep my eyes on focus, as long as I can see the horn of salvation, as long as I can see God over my circumstance, then all this stuff, all these details down here, you know, stuff I went through last year or 6 months ago is it seems so small. Yeah, but when you're in the middle of it, it seems so big. So here's what happened. It says that they go in, they hamstring the horses, they take what's strong. You know, have you ever noticed that the biggest victories in your life are going to come out of the midst of the biggest battles? You know, the bigger the battle, the bigger the victory. You know, the bigger the battle, the more you got to trust and lean on God and have faith. You know, faith sounds so easy and we talk so much about it, but when it comes down to it, we all have such a hard time with it. We think we do good with it. It sounds really good because we can talk it up really good, but really, when it gets down to the details, we all live with a little bit of fear. I'm just being real. If you don't, then I want to be your best friend. All right, so Joshua 11:8. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them until they left none of them remaining. So Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Joshua turned back at that time and took Hazor and struck its king with the sword, for Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. And then he burned Hazor with fire. Verse 13, but as for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them except Hazor only, which Joshua burned. So here's the thing. They have all these 16 different kings and kingdoms. But the main king was the king of Hazor. And Hazor, the king of Hazor, was the one that went to all the other kings and started rounding them up. Listen, we need to come against this God of Israel because they're doing way more than we want them to do. And eventually they're going to overthrow us. So he was the stronghold. Hazor was the stronghold of all this problem that Joshua was in. He had compiled all of this stuff around him. You know, usually when you have a problem that you're going through, there's one main circumstance. We have all these little things that happen, but there's one main thing that's always a stronghold. So basically, God goes in and says, listen, I'm going to have you overtake it, but when you get to Hazor, I want you to utterly burn it and destroy everything. Don't leave anything usable. So everything else, they conquer, but Hazor, they go in and they destroy. Now, I found online in 1926, excavators dug up the city of Hazor. And it showed that as they dug down, they started finding these walls. And it looked as though the city of Hazor had been built and then destroyed and then built and destroyed and built and destroyed. But they finally got down to a layer where they believe was the layer that Joshua had destroyed. And the reason they knew is because when they got there, they uncovered the walls, and all around the walls was still soot all around. And it had burned so deep and so hot and so fast that it left a mark that could be not be undone. These are pictures. I don't know if you can tell, but at the top up there where it's all black, it goes all the way around. Show the next picture. So there's a layer. You can see the layer of soot. And they had built, later on, they built more kingdoms going on and on. And so as these cities were built, it was built on top of this one layer that they believe came from Joshua. And it says, I looked it up, it says they believe that it was over 2,300 degrees Fahrenheit. And they say that over 2,200 degrees in a kiln, just in a kiln, it's so hot and the light is so bright, you can't look in and see anything. Your eyes can't focus on anything because it's so bright and it's so hot. And it was hotter than that. And they believe it was because they believe there was so much wood and there were so many storehouses of olive oil that it ignited so fast and so hot that there was nothing anybody can do. And it says that when you get around fire that hot, that your body instantly, within seconds, your nerve endings instantly are gone. You don't feel anything. You just are done. You're gone. So basically what happened is God went in and said, okay, Hazor is the stronghold for all of your problems. So what I want you to do is burn it in such a way that generations to come are going to be able to look back and go, look what God did. He left such a mark on his generation that generations later, that in the Bible it talks about it, that right now we're talking about it. In 2018, we're talking about what happened so many years ago with Joshua. He left that kind of a mark. What kind of a mark are we leaving in our circumstances to the people around us? You know, it's not even just about leaving a legacy and having a name when you're dead and gone and being famous. But do you make God famous in your circumstances? Is the mark of God so heavy and so strong and burns so hot in your life that it's undeniable that it was God? Or are you just living day to day? When I was, obviously, most of you know I had the privilege of growing up with Pastor Susan. I grew up in church. It's a good thing, you know, whatever. So I grew up in church, and we went to a Christian school, and this is my shameless plug. If you need your kids to go to a Christian school, come talk to me. We have an amazing one. But as I grew up in a Christian school, I remember being about, I want to say about five, and we lived on Cornell, and we had this long kitchen counter. I'm assuming it was long. I was little, so I'm assuming it was long. Kitchen counter. And I remember my dad one day after church, he set me up on the counter, and he probably wouldn't remember, but he told me, hey, do you want to ask Jesus into your heart? And I was like, yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to have a little guy in his heart, you know? So, yeah, I prayed the prayer. And so then I was so excited. I thought it was so fun. I remember having him do it like two or three more times. We sat over by the phone where the phone hung, and he, you know, obliged, and we prayed a couple times. And I probably didn't really fully understand it, you know, as a five-year-old could. And so we go to this Christian school, and I remember on Wednesdays we had chapel. And so when I was about 6 years old, I remember this lady coming in, and it was a Baptist school, I think, at the time. But either way, it was about second grade, and I remember at chapel, we were all sitting there in the pews, you know, ready to be bored. And this lady comes in, and she was a missionary, and she was from Africa. And she brought pictures, and she brought all these necklaces and musical instruments and all these bright colored things. But she told about how she would go into Africa and she would help the kids and she would build these places and she'd bring them medicine and she'd give them Bibles and they never heard about Jesus. And I was like, what? They've never heard about Jesus. I mean, we hear about Jesus all the time. How do they never hear about Jesus? And so I remember sitting there thinking, wow, how amazing is that? Like, there's people that don't know Jesus, and not just don't know him, like, they never heard about him. I hear about him every Sunday. And so I was just enamored by this lady who talked about Africa and all this stuff she did. And so from then on, I remember, probably not all the time, but a lot of the time I remember as a kid, people would go, what do you want to be when you grow up? How many have ever asked a kid that? Right? It's like the dumbest question to ask a five-year-old. It's cute, but it's probably not real smart. So I remember after that, I would be like, I want to be a missionary to Africa, because I thought her job sounded really fun. You know, who doesn't want to go to Africa, apparently? And it's far, far away, and you get to play with stuff and kids, and you tell them about Jesus and all these toys and whatever else. And so, you know, a couple years go by, and I ended up in my fourth grade class, Miss Holiday. Yeah, there's my fourth grade class. My white straight hair over on the corner. Yeah, there it was. My bowl cut. Thank you, Robin. Did you do that to me? So wrong. So, Miss Holiday. So, fourth grade. Yeah, I wasn't, I always joke that I am the no child that was left behind. You know, I'm not the academic kid. I didn't get A's. If I did, I probably cheated. Which, honestly, I don't remember ever cheating, so it was probably an accident, which is even dumber. And so, I just was not the smart kid. I wasn't the academic kid. I went to summer school. I stuttered a lot. I had a hard time just understanding a lot of stuff. It was hard. School was always hard. So I always say, I don't know how I graduated. Somehow I did. I didn't know there was such thing as credits in high school until my counselor was like, you're short a couple credits. And I was like, what's that? Just saying. All right, so fourth grade. So I remember a couple months into fourth grade, and Miss Holiday was a really tough teacher. And I won't say she wasn't nice, but she wasn't real friendly. So I remember as a fourth grader that we had to write this essay. And we had to write an essay about what we wanted to be when we grew up. And so, of course, I wrote, I want to be a missionary to Africa, because why not? This lady says it's really cool. I could do it. Anybody can be a missionary to Africa. So I wrote this whole essay. I was really excited about what I was going to do. And so I don't know how much longer later, but I remember getting it back, and I flunked. And I was used to doing that, but I was pretty excited about this essay because it said what I wanted to do, but she flunked me on it. And I don't remember if I ended up making up the grade or what ended up happening with it, but all I remember is her handing me the paper and saying, you know, it's an unrealistic goal. You need to write about something realistic. And I thought, what? I thought being a missionary was what we were allowed to do. The lady said it in chapel, and I've been saying it the last couple years, and so I was pretty disappointed, and obviously it made an impact, because I still remember today standing at her desk because she told me it was unrealistic and handed me my paper. And so, yeah, I went a couple years, and I still thought, gosh, being a missionary to Africa sounds really cool. But I kind of put it in the back of my mind, and you're a kid, and it's not like you sit around thinking about it all day. And so I was about 13 or 14, and I had a friend come home and said that there's this thing called Teen Mania, and they take kids, and they go to other nations, and you get to be a missionary. And I was like, what? There's a thing called Teen Mania? Oh, my gosh. So I ordered the brochure, because we didn't have online. You got to snail mail everything. So I waited for it, and I remember sitting in the church office and looking at the brochure. It was in color. It was amazing. And so I picked the place I wanted to go, and I told my parents, I want to go to Teen Mania. It was for a whole week, and we left on Christmas Day. And I don't know if they thought I was nuts, which I probably was. I mean, I was that no child left behind. So I raised my money, and I decided I was going to go to Bahamas. Now, every time I tell somebody I went to Bahamas, they think, oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's not amazing. If you've been to Bahamas but never gotten off the boat, you probably had a great time. If you've been to Bahamas and got off the boat where it's not tourists, you probably will never go back. It's horrible. It's like a really bad little Mexico. It's bad. It's a bad place. Great people, horrible poverty, very diminished. They don't have hardly anything. So we fly to Florida. They train us. They teach us all these dramas. I had to be a hippie in a drama. Go figure. And so they teach us these dramas, and then they fly us to this little city called Eleuthera. I think that's how we said it. And so we would sit around, and we'd talk to these kids. I think I have another picture of kids. And we'd talk to the kids about God, and we'd do these dramas, and we'd pray with them. And I was like, oh, my gosh, it's amazing. Well, then we started walking through their city, and we started seeing where they lived. And I was like, wow, like, you live here. Like, this is a nice part of town. Like, our nice part of town does not look like this. And so it really, really impacted my life. And I remember that at night we would go back and we slept on the floor in a schoolhouse and we ate grits. That's what I remember. I didn't like grits, but we had a lot of grits. And so I remember we went home, and it was only for a week. I think I was about 14. And I remember thinking, wow, they have like hardly anything. I mean, as a kid, that's like a big wake-up call. And I remember thinking, I got a lot of stuff, and I don't need a lot, and they need a lot, and they don't have a lot of stuff. And so it was like kind of a really big impact. Well, then, a couple months later, I'm still 14, and this lady, very eccentric, Joanna Petronella, I don't even know how you found her. She came in, and she taught, I don't know, some night service, I think. And the only thing I remember is she says in her service, yes, I'm going to Russia on a missions trip. And I was like, what? You're going where? And so I found her because I'm the pastor's kid. So, you know, I figure out how to get the back door of places. So I took her aside and I said, hey, you're going to Russia? And she said, yeah. And I said, do you take people with you? Oh, yeah, we have a whole team going. Can I go? And she gave me like this really weird look. But I didn't catch on. And so I said, so is that like a yes? Like, can I go? Well, it's a lot of money, honey. It's like $6,000. You'd have to raise a lot of money. We're leaving in a couple of months. I said, okay, so if I raise the money, can I go? Yeah, okay, if you raise the money. So I remember I called her back. I raised the money. I called her back somehow. I don't know how we raised the money. Asked a lot of people. Some of you are probably still here. I'm sorry. We raised the money, and the congregation gave money. They gave medicines, and she was going to visit some hospitals and pray over kids that were affected by Chernobyl. And so we went, and I called her back, and I said, I have my money. I met her at LAX. My mom dropped me off. I think she cried when she left. Sorry about that. And so I flew off for a couple weeks to Russia, and we show up, and I think I have a couple pictures here. We show up and we go to, what do I have? Oh, I carried bubble gum. Sorry, you have that picture? I packed bubble gum because I was a kid. So half of my suitcase was like for me. And the other half, I bought thousands of pieces of bubble gum and stickers. And I thought, well, what better thing than to go to a hospital and bring bubble gum and stickers? So I did that. So I packed all this stuff. So we end up going to this hospital. And majority of the kids that are here, this little boy I remember had cancer. I don't even know if he's still alive 30-something years later. All these kids were affected in some deformity or some cancer way. I think there's another little girl. Super nice people. We brought all these luggage full of medicines and hospital supplies and everything that we can do. And so while we're there, we have these crowds of people. I mean, Russia was so hungry for the word of God. And so we would go out in the crowd. We'd stand outside their church. And when they'd get out, we would mob them and we'd start praying over them. And the word would spread. There's Christians here, they weren't used to Christians. And at the time, you know, you had to have underground churches, so you couldn't really be real loud about being a Christian. And so I did that. I went home. And that time I was like, wow, like there's people that aren't allowed to have God. So it's not just like they don't have God. They're not allowed to have God. So then, of course, within a year, I hear of another group called the Adams Children Fund. They go to orphanages. And so I somehow connected with them, raised the money, went during a school break, and stayed with a lady named Olga. She thought we were pretty cool. And apparently over there, their pastors, their priests, drink a lot of alcohol. So she gave me vodka to send home. Don't know how I made that through customs. 16, carrying vodka through the airport. So I stayed with Olga. She was a doctor, made $20 at the most a month in American dollars. She thought we were the wealthiest people around. I remember leaving her $100 and she cried and I couldn't figure out why until I realized this was like months and months worth of salary. So we went to a couple of orphanages. I have a picture. I was standing next to a girl that I'm starting to talk to, and she speaks a little bit of English, but come to find out, she was 15 years old, getting ready to turn 16. But back then, I'm assuming it's still the same. Once they turn 16, they no longer have a place to live. You're basically told, here's your papers, go find a job, go find a place to live. And so because of that, there was a lot of homeless. There was a lot of gypsies. You know, this lady was, it's freezing outside. I'm bundled up with my snow boots and my jacket, and she's holding a baby sitting on the side of the road. Little gypsy girl, knew nothing different. And here I am with, you know, fancy snow boots. I remember my parents bought me. And so then we go to another orphanage, and these kids, I realized, you know, majority of them were so little. They grew up knowing no parents, knowing no family. And here we were standing there taking pictures and watching them and playing with them, thinking we were helping. And I think I have a picture of them sitting down. They just thought we were, I don't know, amusement. They thought we were pretty cool, never seen anybody like us. And so we had different kids, and we'd play with them, we'd help build, we'd paint, you know, we did all this stuff while we were there. But then come to find out there was a whole other room in the back of the orphanage that they don't really want you to go in. And the reason they don't want you is they have babies who are really, really sick. But there's not enough workers, and so they pile all these cribs together so they can play through the slats, but they're really sick. So majority of them probably ended up not living. There just wasn't a lot of help. There wasn't any place for them to go. It was life-changing. I learned a lot. I saw a lot. This little girl had only been there for a couple weeks, didn't even have a name, probably about 5 or 6 months old, didn't have a name, was dropped off at the orphanage. The workers didn't have a name for her yet. They were too busy. There just wasn't enough time to stop long enough to help anybody individually. And so we're getting ready to leave, and you know, we had the touristy thing, so we kind of, you know, we'd go through the shopping markets and everybody would buy stuff. And so I had this money. I'm 16. You know, what do you buy? I'm not going to buy dishes and all these antiques or whatever. And so we stopped, and as we were driving, we saw these soldiers on the side of the road. Oh, I had brought bubbles. All the kids mobbed me because I brought bubbles. They'd never seen bubbles. So as we're driving, leaving, we realize these soldiers are on the side of the road in Russia. And we realize communism had fallen not too far before we went there. And majority of these soldiers had never held a Bible. They'd never had a Bible in their hand. And so we pull over and I donate my last $100 to buy more Bibles. And we pass out Bibles to soldiers in Russia. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got a couple Bibles at home and I'm 16 and they've never held a Bible. They've never been allowed to read the Word of God in public. And here we are in abundance of so much. And so I come back and I remember we were in the other sanctuary over there. And I remember I'm showing some of these pictures to the congregation and, you know, I'm telling about everything. And I look out and, of course, who's in the crowd is Miss Holiday. I remember her sitting about halfway back and I thought, oh my gosh. You got a million thoughts going through your head. And she probably doesn't remember what she said to me. She doesn't remember what she wrote on the paper. You know, she's just being a teacher. Maybe she had a bad day, whatever it was. Maybe she didn't do what she always wanted to do and took it out on me. Who knows? The No Child Left Behind. But I remember as I got older, I thought, you know, I probably am a little bit stubborn. I don't know. I probably got that from my mom. Thanks for that. But, you know, there's that thing inside of you that when the enemy tells you, not that she's my enemy, but when the enemy or somebody bullies you and tells you you can't do this or you're not good enough or it's not possible, there's no way, you could never, it will never happen, you're not going to, all of the negative stuff that people like to put on us. Yeah, as I got older, I thought, man, I love that of all days that she showed up on that day. And it probably was nothing to her, but it was everything to me in the fact that as I got older, I started to realize that that's the kind of God I serve. That he puts that thing inside all of us that says, what do you mean I can't do that? You know, as Joshua stood over the 20,000 just horses and chariots, not even soldiers and men, as he stood over all of them in the valley, there had to be something in him that went, what do you mean I'm going to die today? I ain't dying today. I'm not losing. I haven't come through Egypt. I haven't come through the wilderness. I haven't come across the Red Sea. My family hasn't died in the desert for me to die here on the sand of the ocean. This is not where my legacy ends. I'm going to burn out in such a way that it leaves a legacy that everybody's going to see. And I don't care if my name is known as long as the name of God is known. Because, you know, a lot of stories we hear about a missionary did this, or a person did this, or one time a pastor was here, or one time this lady did this. And a lot of times we don't know who the person is. We just know the God attached to the person. And, you know, before I got up, and I got to close, but before I got up, I told Steve I got a text from a new family in our school, and they're they have a little boy, and they're from Egypt, and they've only been here like a week. So I get this text before service, and he says, hey, are you, it's text, so I don't have the accent for it, but are you, is your school Mormon or Catholic or Protestant? And so I wrote back and I said, well, we are definitely Protestant. And my brain's racing. I'm thinking, I don't know what religion this guy is now that I'm thinking about it. And so I said, you know, when you sign the application, there was a statement of faith. And so it talked about what we believe. And he said, well, I didn't read that. You know, it was there. We signed it. I didn't read that. And so I real quick started typing back. We believe the whole word of God to be true. We believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. We believe in the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and the Trinity. We believe in the power of God that was in the Old Testament, and the New Testament is still the testament today. We believe that Jesus died and rose from the grave. And I'm texting all this stuff really fast, you know, and I'm sure there were a few typos. And I said, we believe that everything that happened in Acts happens still today. We believe in healing. We believe in the power of God to manifest in our congregations. And then I went, dot, 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 what do you believe? Question mark. After this long paragraph. And so he wrote back and he said that it's basically an Egyptian Orthodox is what it comes out to. There's a different word for it, but Egyptian Orthodox. And I said, okay, well, is that kind of along the same lines? And he said, yes, we believe in the power of God. And so I stopped him and I just wrote and I said, so your God is the God we serve. And the God I serve is the God you serve. So everything I just wrote, you believe? Question mark. Yes. We were persecuted in Egypt for our Christianity. Our people were persecuted, but we no longer are, and we are Christian. We love your school. We love your church. We want our child to go there until they graduate. And I thought, you know, it doesn't matter if we're in the United States or we're in Egypt or Russia or Bahamas or wherever it is that you want to go. Our God is still the same God as the book in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, and today. Which means that whatever circumstance you're going to, you can be like Joshua and stand over and say, not today, I'm not going to die. This is not where my legacy ends, and I'm going to burn out in such a way that it's not the world's definition of burnout. I'm going to burn out in such a way that I leave a legacy that my name is so known because your name is in it. And everything I can say about my story is because you took over and you are the horn of salvation over my life. Amen?